Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. The Invisible Danger. The summer of 2009 was my first summer away from home. No family, none of my friends. From when I was growing up, nothing familiar to latch onto when things got hard. Nothing. I'd received a job offer out of state that was going to offer some great compensation for the summer months. And given that I hadn't had luck in acquiring any other jobs for the last 5 or 6 months, I wasn't in a position to decline. The job offer actually came my way through Craigslist. It was quite the setup, really. From June through the end of August, I was supposed to be a groundskeeper for a family who needed the extra help after the daughter had left. Apparently, she had been doing a lot of the upkeep on the home and surrounding area, just 3 to 4 acres worth in the maintenance on the house itself. Basically, just keeping the place livable and clean enough for the city standards. The job would pay $3,500 per month. I'd be responsible for work from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. during the weekdays and was able to live in the guest house built right on the acres too. I was already a workhorse and done plenty of DIY work and landscaping growing up and helping my family and friends, and the requirements didn't seem to be anything out of my scope of abilities. I called the number on the ad, explained how I could be down there a week prior to the start date to familiarize myself with the property, as long as they didn't mind me starting early, and the couple agreed without hesitation. It was almost eerie how fast they agreed to it. A couple of weeks later, it was May 22nd, and I flew down to start. Upon arrival, the couple was waiting outside. The father must have been in his late 40s, early 50s, and walked with a severe limp. He had a cigarette in his hand and extended his opposite to shake mine. He told me everyone called him Roo, and that I could too. The wife peeked out from behind him, a frail and timid-looking woman around the same age. She had long, cascading gray and blonde hair, and laughed and said it was his nickname from school back when they were young. I guess it stuck. Her name was Lacey. She had crow's feet so deep on the outside of her eyes, so deep I thought wind couple could seep through them. Small canals of wrinkles sinked across her forehead too. I hoped I would never get that old. They turned to walk towards the home and stopped dead in their tracks after we reached the porch. I saw a boy, a teenage boy. He had short brown hair, dark blue eyes, and freckles splashed across his cheeks. He was hiding halfway behind a pillar supporting the front deck of the house, just peeking his top half out like he was trying to snoop. What a scowl he had on his face. The mother spoke up. Oh yes, this is our son Jason. He's going to be here this summer too and can help you out as much as you need. I could hear the trembling in her voice, like she was nervous and scared that she didn't immediately mention him upon my arrival. I walked to the boy, extended my hand to shake his. He folded back behind the pillar like he was scared himself. Out from the side of the support beam, he crept his arm and my hand met his, freezing cold like he just exited a walk-in freezer. It seemed like I was holding onto an ice block shaped exactly to match my palm. It was a fierce grip though, like he was holding on for dear life. I leaned forward to get another glimpse of his face and he mouthed something out. I didn't catch it at first, but after coming back to the thought multiple times, it looked like, save yourself. The mother and father snuck up behind us and placed their hands on my back. After a little shove, they suggested a tour of the home so I knew my responsibilities while staying for the summer. I agreed and we started the walk through of their home. From the outside, the place seemed to be a great deal to take care of, and I was curious off the bat how their daughter had seemingly taken care of this place when the inside looked so torn up. The wallpaper was chipping on every viewable space. The appliances in the kitchen and bathroom seemed to be outdated, and I wasn't sure they even ran, and the floor beneath us creaked and bent underneath every step it felt. The home was 2 stories, and upon ascending the stairs, several of the wooden steps cracked beneath me. I grabbed onto the guiding banister and caught myself, and the couple apologized. We made it up the stairs. They showed me the three upstairs bedrooms and neglected a pathway that seemed to go up to the one outstanding peak of the home. A loft viewable from the outside as a one-bedroom study, maybe? It seemed to bridge off the house into its own little cubby when viewed in front of the porch when I arrived, but they never made any notion towards it. I assumed it was just a private study for the husband, maybe their personal area with their valuables, and decided to neglect it myself as well. The home, although run down and needed up a lot of work, seemed to be kind of cozy after I was shown its entirety. Once the tour was finished, we came outside and they showed me the guest house. It was a small one-bedroom, living room, kitchen, and bathroom that was perfect for one person to stay and live comfortably at least for a couple of months. The guest home seemed to be a complete 180 from the main living space the couple and son stayed in, and I wasn't quite sure the reason behind that. I thanked them for the tour, and they said, "Anything I need, don't be afraid to ask." I thanked them and they left back to the main home. I locked the door behind them, started to unpack my things, and settle into the place. It was only 4:30 in the afternoon when an old-school dial telephone rang in the corner of the living room. I hadn't noticed it at first, and honestly, the ring startled me. I walked over, assuming it was a couple at the main house, and was greeted with Jason's shy voice. "Save yourself." At that moment, I'll admit my stomach dropped, and I came to the realization of what he first said to me when I shook his hand just an hour or so before. I heard Lacey pipe up in the background and rushed to the phone. "I'm so sorry, sweetie. I told him to let you know dinner is around 5 if you'd like to join us." I thanked her for the offer, assured her that I'd be inside by then and that Jason was no problem. The call disconnected and I leaned back down on the couch, having an internal debate with myself about this strange teenage boy and what he was trying to say, what he was trying to do aside from freak me out, and why he wasn't helping this summer on his own. Why this couple wanted my assistance when they had what looked like a perfectly capable young man to do things around here, aside from looking fiercely jittery. Oh well. Work started tomorrow and I hadn't even been there an entire day and was letting my head get the best of me. I must have dozed off on the couch because a knock on the door woke me up. I leaned up in my groggy state and noticed the light outside had changed to darkness. I must have slept right through dinner. I felt terrible. I pulled myself off the couch, walked to the door, and peeked through the small blind to see Lacey holding a plate of some kind. "I guess you were pretty tired, sweetie. Here's some dinner for you. Rest up, and we'll start tomorrow." She practically dropped the plate into my arms. It was large, covered in foil, and smelled heavenly. I uncovered the edge of it and smelled roast beef, potatoes of some kind, gravy, along with some vegetables. I hadn't had a home-cooked meal like this in some time, so I was quite excited. I brought the plate over to the kitchen counter and set it down, searched through the drawers for some silverware, and couldn't seem to find any. I was so hungry at this point that I just said, "Fuck it," and started shoveling the food in my mouth. It was delicious. The roast beef tore easily with my teeth, the potatoes broke between the roof of my mouth and tongue, and the vegetables washed everything down. I sat back on the couch, feeling tired again. I leaned over, rested my head on the pillow, and before I knew it, the sleep sheep arrived and took me to dreamland. It was hazy. A thick mist covered my surroundings, and you could have cut through it with a knife. I waded through the air, feeling it brush against my face with how full it was. My hair stood up on my arms, legs, and the back of my neck, and I knew something was off. Something was wrong, seriously wrong. I saw Jason, standing in a clearing where the mist wouldn't touch, almost as if the mist itself was afraid to go near his place. He walked towards me, and the air around him quickly dispelled. "Save yourself. If you don't, they'll get you too. Save yourself like my sister did, and run far, far away while you still can." He turned around and walked off deep into the clouds around us, and I stood there. I felt a violent pain start to build in my chest. I looked down. Wearing a white t-shirt, I saw a small red pool begin to cover my chest right above my heart. The pain was so staggering that I woke myself up. I rolled from the couch, clutching my chest, coughing like a thick smoke was covering the room. I leaned forward just far enough to grab hold of the coffee table in the center of the room and pulled myself to my feet. A thick smoke was indeed covering the guest house. I ran towards the kitchen. No sparks, no flames, just the smoke. I went into the bedroom, found no source for it. I opened the front door and the smoke slowly filtered out of the doorway and in the yard, the 100 feet between myself and the main house to Jason, standing in the darkness with a new light illuminating him just enough to see his mouth moving. I knew what he was saying. I knew exactly what he was saying. Save yourself. Lucid nightmare. My first deployment ever was to a large airfield in Afghanistan back in 2009. I got there in the beginning of May. I had already started taking my anti-malarial medication as instructed. Mefloquine was the type I was on. Anyone who has taken anti-malaria meds can tell you that they give you some weird dreams. This goes a little beyond that. Mefloquine takes some time to build up in your system and become effective. That is why you're instructed to start taking the drug for a week or two in advance of arriving in country. It was mid-June when this happened. I had just celebrated my 21st birthday the day prior. Turning 21 in a country where alcohol is illegal is not fun. I had been in country for about 8 weeks, and for the past week or so, the mefloquine had fully kicked in and I was having some of the most vivid, yet strangest dreams I had ever had in my life. They felt incredibly real. But upon reflection, certain things would happen in these dreams that were impossible, and I'd soon forget them. Our living quarters were set up as a sort of prefabricated dormitory. The dorms were Konex boxes stacked and bolted together, then finished and furnished, 4 guys to a box, 12 boxes per floor, 3 floors per dorm. The dorms had local nationals and third country nationals, LNs and TCNs, that were employed to come in and clean the hallways and bathrooms. I never really saw them that much since I was on night shift and slept for the majority of the day. One day, I'd come back to my room after a long shift. I was absolutely exhausted. I changed into my PT gear, the only authorized clothing besides your combat uniform, and hung my M9 in its holster on the bedpost. No sooner did my head hit the pillow than I heard yelling from the hallway. The yelling was from far down on the other end, but I could tell the language was Pashto. The yelling got louder, and I heard a few bangs like someone stomping around, then the unmistakable crack of AK-47 fire. I jumped out of bed and grabbed my M9 and pressed my ear up against my door. The yelling was getting closer. I held my M9 in my right hand, cracked open my door with my left, and slowly peeked my head out just enough to see around the door frame with one eye. The LNs had somehow gotten their hands on weapons and were going door to door, killing those inside. The banging I had heard was them kicking doors in. I backed away from the door and stood in the corner of the room, M9 pointed at the doorway. I could still hear them. A door kicked in, a short scream cut short by 3 to 5 AK rounds. They were next door when I cocked the hammer back and flicked the safety off. Bang, scream, pop, pop, pop. They kicked my door in next. I woke up. I jumped out of bed and grabbed my M9 and pressed my ear up against my door. Nothing. I held my M9 in my right hand, cracked open my door with my left, and slowly peeked my head out just enough to see around the door frame with one eye. Nothing. The hallways were deserted, empty and quiet. I shut the door and collapsed on the floor with my back to it, flicked the safety on my M9 to decock the hammer and set it next to me. My heart rate was out of control. My body was numb and shaking uncontrollably from the adrenaline gushing through my system. There was no way I was getting to sleep right then, so after a few minutes spent trying to calm down, I grabbed my laptop and walked over to the ESO to try to use the Wi-Fi and browse around until I got tired enough to try sleeping again. About an hour or so later, I felt like giving sleep another try, so I closed up my laptop and walked back to the dorm. I opened the door to my hall and froze. There he was, the Afghan that had kicked down my door in my dream. He was at the opposite end of the hall, sweeping the floor. Base security relies on people reporting when they see weird things. I rushed down to the Base Defense Ops Center, BTOC, to file a report. What was I going to say? I couldn't just tell him, hey, I think this guy's going to go on a shooting rampage because I dreamed it. But there was no way I was going back to that dorm without doing something. I told them that I had seen this guy before, but today he was being really shady and acting really jumpy and suspicious. They said they'd look into it. I walked back to the USO and sat outside in a spot where I could see my dorm. A few minutes later, I saw a pair of security forces guys walk into the dorm on my floor. A few minutes after that, they had the cleaning guy in cuffs and wheeled his cleaning cart outside in the sun so they could search it better. I had to suppress a scream when out of his trash bin they pulled an AK-47 and 3 magazines. I didn't get much sleep for the rest of the day. I never had an experience like that before and haven't had any like it since. But Mefloquine still gives me some really weird dreams. No rest at the rest stop. Something about lengthy rural drives used to always relax me. The desolation of the two-lane roads that cut through the southwestern high desert are really unparalleled. It's beautiful. The long stretches of roads where the only visible light is coming from your brights. The long stretches of roads where you feel as if there's an ominous presence. Something malicious constantly lurking in the isolated desert highways. It was March of 2009 and I'm driving from Durango to Phoenix, my residence. I left my ski vacation early as my girlfriend in Phoenix wanted me home. This also meant I had to depart Durango at around 7 p.m. Being young and naive, I drank a few energy drinks, bought a pack of cigarettes, some Chex Mix, and figured I could make it to Phoenix without any issues. A late-season ice storm made travel impossible on the I-160, so I decided to cut my losses and take a slightly longer route that involved cutting through northwestern New Mexico. As civilization faded and as headlights on the other side of the road became a distant memory, it began to snow rather heavily. There was really an eerie, off-putting vibe about the two-lane highway I was on. There wasn't a shred of vegetation in sight, just desolation, pure nothingness. Everything was black except for the moonlight shining a dim light on wet snow that was beginning to coat the empty highway. Feeling as if something was off, I decided to put in a Lynyrd Skynyrd CD and search for the nearest rest stop. Keep in mind, I was on Navajo off-reservation trust land at the time, and I figured I wouldn't be able to find a place to pull over and take a comfortable crap in 50 or so miles. As the snow grew heavier and my eyes wearier, my brights shone upon a small weathered sign that read, Rest Stop, Indian Service Route 5, 2 miles. Fuck yes, I thought. 2 miles and 4 minutes later, I parked my Jeep Cherokee next to the dilapidated building made of concrete. The building itself sends shivers down my spine, not because rest stops are nasty, but because the building generally just rubbed me wrong. I told myself to grow some balls, put on the emergency brake, and walked into the rest stop. The rest stop consisted of a man and woman's bathroom. Being a man, I walked in the men's restroom, which reeked of sulfur for some strange reason. I attributed it to the fact that it was a bathroom, and found one of two stalls. My unease only grew when I realized there weren't any lights in the bathroom. I debated getting back in my car and holding it, but I decided against it. Only rest stop in the area, I figured. I looked for a light switch, but gave up as it seemed futile. I opened up a stall and turned on my BlackBerry's camera as a flashlight. As I was finishing up, I became paralyzed in fear. The lights turned on. I didn't hear a light switch. Nor did I see one, but lights just turned on, out of nowhere. It was the most abrupt, heart-stopping thing I've experienced. I sat still, making an effort to not breathe noticeably. I was creeped out beyond belief. That's when I heard the footsteps. They almost sounded like a pair of hooves, just softly making their way through the restroom. Then I heard the breathing, a guttural, loud, animalistic breathing that seemed to be coming from right outside my stall. I heard the footsteps. I heard the breathing, but I didn't see anything. Nothing. I swear to this day, whatever it was breathing right outside my stall, but I simply didn't see any sign of anything from where I was sitting. Minutes passed, and the breathing came to a halt. My heart, having almost abruptly stopped at least 6 times in those 6 minutes, finally beat in a more normal fashion, regardless how certain death awaited me outside the stall door. So I decided to wait it out. That is when I heard the sound of a sink turn on, releasing water for about 20 seconds before it was promptly turned off. More minutes passed, and while the lights remained on, I couldn't hear anything. I decided to man up and check outside the stall. At first glance, there wasn't anything in the bathroom. At a second glance, I realized there weren't even sinks in the bathroom either, just small containers of hand sanitizer. Fear set in even deeper, and I realized I was dealing with something truly, truly malevolent, something paranormal. I always considered myself a skeptic until that earth-shattering moment where I desperately looked for some sinks. Was I going insane? If not, then what the fuck was in the bathroom? These questions, I had little time to ponder as I sprinted out of the bathroom and into the frigid, snowy night. I fumbled for my keys and quickly started my car. As the brights turned on, something caught my eye. In a snowbank standing next to the wall of the building was some sort of coyote, perched on its hind legs. Its eyes, while not pointed at me, seemed inhuman, absolutely out of this world. My heart pounding, I skidded out of the parking lot, soon driving 50 miles an hour down the icy road. I began to calm down until I glanced in my rearview mirror. The fucker was chasing me on its hind fucking legs. When I say this fucker was fast, it was nearly catching up to a 50-mile-an-hour SUV in a snowstorm. I'm not exaggerating. I was scared shitless, crying as I tried to drive faster without skidding off the road. Fortunately, I lost whatever it was. But to this day, I have vowed to never drive alone at night again, and to never, under any circumstances, stop at a rest stop in New Mexico. But I'm so hungry. As a doctor, I'm bound by doctor-patient privilege to not disclose the specifics of what I'm about to tell you. But as a human being, I feel compelled to share. This is, without a doubt, the most horrific story I've ever had the displeasure of being a part of. It was 2009 and my schedule that day was light. I was just finishing up my lunch when I got a call from a friend and a colleague who had his own practice in the same building as me. Sometimes we would send work each other's way when we knew the other could use it. I was a bit elated at the prospect of him calling me because I had just been going over my books and stressing a bit. "Are you busy right now? I'd like to send someone up to you," he said. "No, my afternoon is barren. What are the details?" "It's a walk-in. From the look of it, an eating disorder. Her mother is concerned." Eating disorder. Those can be unpleasant. I had actually had a bulimic throw up in my office once when I had stepped out momentarily to check my calendar. Still, I needed the work. "All right, send her up." I tried to tidy up my desk to make my office look more presentable and professional while I waited. 10 minutes ticked by and no patient showed up, so I stepped out to go looking for her. When I got to the hall, there was a small contingent of people standing around the elevator. They were talking amongst themselves. "What's going on?" I asked. "The elevator's broke," someone said. "Shit, I bet she's on there," I thought. "What floor is it stuck on?"
"The 10th and 11th.
"Yeah, that would be about right. My colleague's office was on the 10th, 3 floors down. I knew from experience that it could be anywhere up to an hour before they got the elevator working again. I hoped she wasn't claustrophobic. Returning to my office, I called downstairs. "What's up?" my colleague asked after picking up. "She's stuck in the elevator," he laughed. "Really? Poor thing. What's her name?"
"Amelia," he paused.
"Amelia D. something."
"All right, thanks. If you got any impressions on her from your brief visit, maybe you can share them later over drinks."
"Sure, don't tell me. I want to form my own opinion first."
"Okay."
True to form, an hour and 10 minutes later, I heard a loud cheer from the hallway indicating the elevator had started working again. "I should go make sure she's all right," I thought to myself, and went out to join the throng of people standing around the hallway. There were a lot more people by then, and I couldn't make my way to the elevator doors or even see them from where I was, but I could hear it when the elevator dinged, indicating it was stopping on our floor, and the rolling mechanical sound of the doors opening. There was a loud gasp from the crowd of people, followed by a lot of jabbering.
"Holy shit!" someone said quite loudly. People started hustling away from the elevator, shoving past me. I struggled against the tide and made my way to where a number of people were standing around, staring into the elevator cab. As I approached, I could smell a stench. It was like stumbling into the apartment of a recluse who hadn't come out or bathed for years. It rolled like a wave out of the elevator and cascaded over everyone in the hallway. A young man in a business suit, who looked dressed for an interview, was covering his mouth and nose with a handkerchief. I skirted around him to see into the elevator. The woman in the elevator was not at all what I was expecting. Massively obese, she looked like she weighed somewhere between 500 to 600 pounds. Her face was so puffed up, her eyes were barely visible, just two dark dots above her cheeks. She had frizzed out brown hair that still had curlers in it. The notion that I was smelling a recluse seemed all the more plausible at the sight of her. Her mouth was covered in what looked like greasy barbecue sauce. There was even some sort of gristle at the corners of her lips. There was more of it all over her hands and wiped down the front of her shirt. It looked like she had come straight from an all-you-can-eat rib buffet. Clenched tightly in one of her hands was a big black trash bag that sagged full of something that seemed to slosh around inside it. The smell coming out of it was nauseating. The woman stepped out of the elevator, her eyes and nose running with tears and mucus. I stepped forward while everyone else backed away horrified. "Amelia?" I asked her. She looked at me through her beady little piggy eyes, her cheeks covered with that vile red gunk and streaking with tears, and opened her mouth. For about 3 seconds, I had the horrible notion that she was going to vomit an entire barbecue on me. "Ah, I was hungry," she stuttered with a thick southern accent. The young man in the suit heaved involuntarily at the smell of her breath and then strode away, trying to maintain his demeanor. "That's okay," I said, reaching to help her. "Do you want to talk about it in my office?" Seeing me reach out to her, she clenched her black trash bag tightly and hugged it to her chest. The contents of it made a sickening squish sound. I could taste my own lunch in the back of my throat. "Is that yours?" I asked. "I'm not going to take it." She started sobbing. This horrible, almost hob-like squeal of a sob. Honestly, I didn't want to touch her. I wanted to go back into my office, lock the door, and pretend I was glad my afternoon was completely empty. The smell wafting off her and off that bag of spoils was going to be permeating every crevice of my office for days. I just knew it. Still, this was a human being that had come seeking my help, and I was not about to turn her away. "My office is right down the hall. Why don't you come with me?" I started walking. In my head, I said, "If she doesn't come with me, fuck it. She can go back to her apartment that's probably filled with roaches and feces and who knows what other ungodly things, and I'll find someone else to help." But she followed me, lumbering on legs that stretched the limits of the sweatpants she had on. I held the door open for her and she waddled in, kneading the contents of that trash bag in her thick sausage fingers, making it belch and splurch. She stopped and just stood there in the middle of my office. The elevator got stuck," she mumbled. "Yes, I'm sorry about that. I hope you were all right. Thank goodness you brought something to eat, yes?" She started crying again, squeezing her trash bag, and I was afraid it was going to explode and leave God knows what all over my office floor. She nodded as her face turned red and tears poured out of seemingly every pore of her head. I went and got her box of tissues and handed her a couple. She tried to take them while still holding onto the bag with both hands. "Would you like me to hold that?" I offered, praying she'd say no. She shook her head. "What do you have in there?" I finally decided to ask. She huffed and snorted, trying to inhale all the fluid back into her face. Using one of the tissues, she mopped her eyes and mouth, getting blotchy red smears all over one place. Leftovers, she stuttered. Then her chest started heaving as she threw her head back and started bawling again. Her face was like a fountain. She was so utterly miserable, and I really started to feel bad for her. "Look," I said, "getting stuck in that elevator was obviously pretty traumatic." Her wailing hit a crescendo. "So why don't we postpone things until you've calmed down a bit?" She struggled through her sobbing. You want to meet with me?" "Well, yes, but not today. Why don't you go home and try to relax? I don't think you're in the right frame of mind right now to talk, but I want to help you. So let's schedule an appointment for later this week. How does that sound?" I walked back to my desk, got out one of my cards. Her mouth was quivering and she looked ready to collapse into a pile of screaming phlegm, but she was calming down a bit, just nodding more than anything, and she took my card with the same sticky fingers holding several drippy tissues. Thank you, she said quietly. I couldn't read her face at all. Her features were so red and swollen and wet that she seemed almost blank and expressionless. "Do you want me to escort you down to the lobby?" I asked, "in case something happens with the elevator again. It should be all right, but I don't want you to be nervous." She shook her head. "That don't seem like a good idea." "Okay." And with that, she turned around and waddled out of my office slowly, sobbing slightly every now and then. With her went that sloshy black trash bag, and with them both went that putrid aroma of filth and squalor. I literally breathed a sigh of relief as I heard the door click shut. She never called back. It was a week later I finally got around to having drinks with my colleagues from downstairs. We were relaxing, having a couple of beers, and I suddenly remembered her. "Oh, thanks, by the way," I said. "For what?" "For Amelia."
"Who?"
"Amelia. Eating disorder? Last week you sent her up to me, remember?"
"Oh, right," he sipped his beer. "The one who got stuck in the elevator. How did that go?"
"She was a wreck," I said, sobbing and practically hysterical. "I talked her into rescheduling, but she hasn't called me to make an appointment."
"Did you talk to her mother?"
"No, I didn't get any information from her. I gave her my card."
"What do you think?" he asked.
"Classic food dependency," I said. "Definitely a binge eater. Her face was just all..."
"No, not the mother. I mean, Amelia."
"What?"
"What did you think of Amelia?" he said again.
"I'm telling you what I thought."
"Amelia, the scrawny 12-year-old girl, you think is a binge eater?"
"What?
No, that's not..."
And then it hit me.
"Was her mother with her?"
"Yeah, I sent them both up to you."
"They were in the elevator together."
He looked at me, and the same dawning realization came over his face. Needless to say, she never rescheduled. Amelia D. something, nor did her mother, the nameless, obese woman I met that day at the elevator, smelling like death, covered in gore and carrying her trash bag of sloshing leftovers.